Online we have Representative Edgman, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, Representative Kawasaki, and Representative Wilson. Is Representative Munoz online? If so, sing out. She's supposed to be coming shortly. Good morning, everybody. We have several friends from the Department of Corrections and several friends from the court system here and friends from the Fourth Estate as well. We're here today to hear a presentation on Alaska Prison Growth Drivers and Costs from Terry Schuster of the Pew Charitable Trust, recognizing the challenges of getting corrections costs under control. We set up a recidivism task force last year, and to get even more mental reinforcements working, we earlier this year invited the Pew Trust to look at our corrections system. Just wanted to give us their recommendations on how we can keep prison populations down in order to avoid the need to build another prison. Their final report, I understand, is due next month, but Mr. Schuster was in town this week, stopped off for some chilly weather, so we asked him to give the committee an update on the progress he's made so far. So with that, I'd invite Mr. Schuster to come to the table with your reinforcements if necessary. And
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
This is David Guttenberg. Could you just ask them to tell us when they're changing pages on the PowerPoint?
Great. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Good idea. And if any other representatives should show up, the LIOs or the Capitol, just sing out. We'll log you for the record. Ms. Schuster, please identify yourself and title for the record.
Representative Sadler?
Representative Millett is also online. Thank you.
I'm online.
Okay.
Chairman, members, my name is Terry Schuster. I'm from the Pew Charitable Trust. As many of you know, we are providing nonpartisan data analysis and technical assistance to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. The commission was charged with coming up with recommendations for this legislative session aimed at holding offenders accountable, improving public safety, and curbing correction spending. What this presentation focuses on is what's driving the growth in the prison population over the last decade, and then looking forward over the next decade, what does that continued growth look like absent additional changes, reforms? And what does it cost? So I put together about 15 slides to help tell that story. Please interrupt whenever you have a question. If we go straight through the slides, it doesn't take a whole lot of time, but we've got enough time to really do a lot of question and answers. I'm going to switch to the first slide right now, which is about population growth over the last decade.
Okay.
So the prison population in Alaska has grown 27% over the last decade. That's significant growth over a 10-year period. By comparison, if you were to look at the resident population growth in Alaska, the resident population grew by about 10% over that same period of time. So the prison population is growing roughly three times as fast as the resident population. I'm switching to the next slide now. This is a pie graph that is a snapshot on any given day, this is one particular day, of what types of inmates are in Alaska's prisons. You can see on any given day, half of the prison population are sentenced offenders. That's people who have been found guilty, they've been sentenced to a term in prison, and they are currently in prison on this day. A little bit more than a quarter of the population are pretrial, so they're awaiting their hearings, or they've been arrested, they have not yet been convicted. And then a little bit less than a quarter of the population are supervision violators. So those are people who are on probation or parole and being supervised in the community, and they've violated the terms of their supervision conditions, and so they are back in prison on a violation, either being penalized or waiting for a hearing about that violation. Are there any questions about this pie before we move on?
Actually, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I'm hearing you say is the pretrial folks that are waiting, and then the folks that may have had a parole violation, and they are potentially pretrial as well because they haven't been found guilty or not, but they're back in waiting to find that. So could there be some sort of overlap in that regard? So, I mean, we may have technically even a bigger pretrial bunch based on that kind of thinking.
Right, so you can cut that data different ways. You can say, take a look at everyone who is pre-hearing, including those people who are waiting for a violation hearing for the supervision. Technically, the way that I have been thinking about this is supervision violators have been sentenced. They've been sentenced to probation, or they were sentenced to prison and they are out on parole and now they're back on a violation. So they have been sentenced, and then they have these terms of supervision in the community, and they've violated those terms. So there's some of them who are in pre-hearing, like you said, and there's some of them who've been revoked, and they're serving a penalty, you know, whether it's five-day revocation or a 30-day revocation or something like that. So, yes, the pretrial population could be bigger if you were to include those pre-hearing supervision violators, but we didn't include that here because we wanted to pull out and talk about the growth in that population separately from the growth in the pretrial population.
Right, no, just listen, I'm hoping there's some data that backs up. I'm specifically honing in on the supervision violator aspect, just on how easy, how difficult it is to not break probation in regards to just what kind of rules we have that make it so, so very difficult, i.e. if you can't drive to somewhere where you need to give a urinalysis test, then I guess you're going to break it, but you're not allowed to drive. So, I mean, I'm looking for the catch-22s. So I'll listen as we go on.
Okay. Mr. Schuster, let me just kind of help set the stage a bit. Give us, for the record, brief information about the Pew Trusts, what they are, where they get their funding, what's your mission, why are you involved in this kind of work, just to scope things.
Sure. So the Pew Charitable Trust is a public charity. We are involved in a lot of different projects around the country that are falling into one of two camps. Either it's research and putting out publications, you've heard of the Pew Research Center maybe, and then, or it's technical assistance. The technical assistance is largely in the area of government performance, which means we have projects that are aimed at helping governments operate more efficiently for the public good. So the version of that that is in the arena of corrections is how do you get a better return on your investment in terms of the spending on corrections and the return being public safety. But there's also projects that have to do with state pensions, with food safety, with early childhood education. They're all sort of variations on this theme of how can you help government be more efficient for the public good. So Pew is interested in this arena and public safety for about 7 or 8 years. It first started with a series of publications about national trends in corrections and what Pew was seeing that sort of got the organization interested in providing technical assistance in this arena was really dramatic growth across the country in prison populations. And so over the last 30 or 40 years, prison populations in the United States increased by about 300%. And it cost the state, when we look at like state budget figures, it was the fastest growing state budget item in almost every single state behind Medicaid. It was an area that was of a lot of interest. We reached the point in 2008 when Pew really started assisting states with taking on or making some sort of corrections reforms. We reached the point when one in 100 American adults was behind bars. When you count number of people on probation and parole, it was one in 33 people were under some form of correctional control in the United States. And it was a really big growing budget item for states, which got a lot of people's attention around the recession.
Okay. And is Pew's interest motivated by any particular philosophy or just a good government attitude, or what's motivation to be involved in this area?
So Pew is a public charity. All of the assistance that we're providing is paid for by the Pew Foundation. It was set up as a family foundation that the Pew family is made their money with the Sun Oil Company. Mm-hmm. And the children who inherited that fund, they kept a salary for themselves and put all the rest into a charitable trust that was for the public good.
Very good. Thank you. I got a question on the slide, actually. Number two, I'll call it the pie chart. About half of the inmates are sentenced, a quarter each year, pretrial and violation of probation. How does that compare with other states? And any place you can point out where Alaska is special or an outlier in these charts would be really helpful.
Okay, I don't think Alaska is an outlier on this chart, on this particular graph right here. It's a little bit hard to compare Alaska to other states because other states are working with counties, and counties have county jails that are separate from the state prison system. The numbers don't always are, it's not apples-to-apples comparisons when you say, well, who's in Alaska prisons versus who's in Kentucky prisons or who's in Texas prisons. because there is this population that would be pulled out that are held in county jails. So here you're seeing a sort of combination of people who would be housed in county jails, people who are pretrial and people who have short sentences, and also people who would be housed in state prisons, people who have longer sentences. So it's a little bit hard to compare to other states. With regard to what you're seeing on the screen right now, this is not particularly out of the ordinary.
Okay, great. Thank you.
What is out of the ordinary is this next slide, which is the growth.
Good segue.
Yeah. The reason why people in Alaska ought to be interested in corrections and the numbers here is there was significant growth over the last 10 years. And we want to understand what's driving the growth in the prison population. Why is it that the numbers keep going up, and what would it cost if the numbers continue to go up in the future? So what we've done here, I took the same colors that were in the pie chart before and split them up into two stacked bar graphs to show how those numbers have changed over time. This is a single snapshot on a day in 2005 and a day in 2014. You can see the increases starting at the bottom. The purple section of the stacked bar graph represents sentenced offenders, and that population has grown 14% over the last decade. The pretrial population is in the middle, this kind of light green section, and that population has grown 81% over the last decade. And then the top part is supervision violators. That population has also grown 15% over that period of time. So the rest of this presentation tries to break down for each of those inmate types, what's driving that growth so we can understand it better so that you all can figure out where you might want to focus in terms of policy options to address that growth. And the Criminal Justice Commission has been focused on this and has been working on recommendations for you all to consider. Their recommendations come out December 10th.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure and give the folks, legislators online, the opportunity to ask any questions they want to. This is a shorter presentation. We should have the chance for a lot of questions and discussion. So anybody online have questions? If not, then we'll go to the room. Representative Guerra.
If you're going to get to this at a different point, that's fine. I looked through your PowerPoint. I just didn't see anything. There's the whole issue of crimes becoming felonies just because of inflation, right? So you steal a bandsaw, and let's just say that the value of that bandsaw in 1975 was the exact amount that kept you at a misdemeanor, but within a couple years with inflation, that becomes a felony. And do other states update both the fines we charge to criminal defendants and the amounts that turn things into from one level of crime to another? Because the second part, you've established a policy, and you mean for somebody to be a misdemeanor defendant, and then just due to the change in the value of the dollar, they become a felony defendant, and it then costs the state a huge amount of extra money for something that I think wasn't intended. So do other states deal with that?
Yes. So the in the past few years, about 23 states have raised the threshold in their statutes for when the value of something that is stolen counts as a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor in order to try and track inflation. There are some jurisdictions that are looking for ways to have that be automatically indexed to inflation. The recommendations for Alaska are still being worked out. The Criminal Justice Commission is trying to find consensus, and that's certainly one of the things they're talking about is what should be the threshold for when something, when a theft or damage to property becomes a felony.
Thank you. And I know you work for the commission, so are you allowed to, on that point, the 23 states that have sort of modified those threshold amounts? And actually, I would want to protect victims in the state in terms of fines collected from defendants as well, but would you be able to get any publication that addresses those states' efforts to members of this committee, or are you just, or are you not able to because you work for the commission?
So Pew is interested independently in this topic, and so we have a team of PhD criminologists that are working on a number of publications. One of those publications is this specifically, looking at those 23 states that have raised their felony threshold, try to track how has is there any relation to crime following that period of time? Is there any relation to collection of restitution and that sort of thing? That publication's in the works. I don't know how soon it'll be ready for prime time.
Okay. That's a little disappointing, but I think that's all
right,
thanks.
Right. We know right now that there is not there's not any measurable connection between crime rate and the felony theft threshold. So for states that have raised their thresholds, property crime did not increase afterwards, at least not in any measurable kind of trend that we could see. There were some states where it increased, most states it decreased. Generally, across the United States, property crime rates are going down and have been since the mid-90s.
Okay. We'll follow up? Or? I do have a question on the slide 3 again. Do you have this information broken down by regions in the state? We kind of use judicial districts, but there's some pretty different demographics and social conditions in different parts of the state. Do you have this broken down by region?
We have the raw data, so we could query the data in order to break it out by region, but we have not done that for this presentation.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, so I'll move on to the next slide. What I've done here is just sort of highlight the piece of the pie that we're going to talk about for the next couple of slides. So the pretrial population is what we're going to talk about for the next couple of slides. Moving on to the next slide, this is a line graph showing the growth in the pretrial population over the last decade. In this 10-year period, really just the last 5 years, the pretrial population has gone up 81%. There are two things that can cause that growth. Either more people are arrested and brought into jail pretrial, or people are spending longer periods of time detained pretrial, and those longer periods of time are stacking up the population. Or it could be both. So we want to look at both of those things, who's coming in, how long are they staying, and what are the trends over time. So that's what the next two slides are. This one is a stacked bar graph, 2005 and 2014, looking at who's coming into prison pretrial. The stacked bar graph on the left is 2005. The different color blocks represent the severity of the offense. So from top to bottom, that dark green segment is people who are coming in on nonviolent misdemeanor charges. Then violent misdemeanor charges are the lighter green. The darker purple are nonviolent felony charges, and the lighter purple are violent felony charges. Mm-hmm. So the first takeaway from this slide is that the numbers are going down. You have fewer people in 2014 being arrested and admitted to prison pretrial than you did in 2005, and it's significantly fewer. So when we look, if I go back one slide, if we look at this growth line here, this 81% growth, this was not caused by more people being arrested and brought into prison pretrial, because those numbers are going down. Instead, it was caused by longer length of stay during the pretrial period. The second main takeaway from this slide is that if we look at last year, 2014, and we look at the green segment of this bar, that represents all of the people in on misdemeanor charges. That is about three-quarters of all the people who are brought into prison pretrial. So only about a quarter of people who are coming into prison pretrial are coming in for felony charges. All the rest are coming in for lower-level charges. So I'll move on to the next slide.
Mm-hmm.
This slide looks at average length of stay during the pretrial period and how that has changed over the last decade. The lighter blue bars on this graph represent average length of stay in prison in 2005, and the darker blue bars represent average length of stay in prison in 2014. So you can see with regard to any of the charges, whether they're the most serious on the left or the least serious on the right, length of stay has increased across the board. So again, we're talking only about the amount of time between when someone was arrested and when they were released pretrial. So for some people, they stayed detained that whole period of time until they were convicted, and for some, they were able to post bail and be released earlier. If we look at the bars on the far right, these are people who were arrested for nonviolent misdemeanor charges. 10 years ago, they were staying for an average of about 6 days pretrial. And today they're staying on an average about 9 days. It's a 3-day increase. It may not sound like a very big increase, but remember, we're talking about a lot of people. So if we go back and look at the slide before, over 11,000 people last year came in on nonviolent misdemeanor charges. So if you have a 3-day increase in average length of stay and you multiply that by thousands and thousands of people, that adds up to a lot of prison beds that the state was not using 10 years ago.
I might be jumping the slides. I know you're giving us a lot of data. I'm looking for some analysis. Why are we seeing such a significant increase in the pretrial stay length? Is it, I'm not sure, but bail conditions are harder to meet?
Right.
Do we not have enough courts? Why?
This is a really hard question to answer. There could be a lot of different things that are affecting pretrial length of stay, and we're not, with the data available, we're not actually able to isolate what it is that's driving those lengths of stay up. So it could be that that the bail that is being set is out of reach for more people. Or it could be that there are just different people who are practicing in as prosecutors or as judges. And the change in personnel itself just resulted in change in practices. Or it could be any number of other things that...
Change in practices.
Every time somebody's coming up in front of a magistrate or a judge for a decision about whether they should be released pretrial, and if so, what are the conditions, that's an individualized decision. There could be changes in bail schedules around the state. There could be changes in who's coming in, but what types of people are coming in, what types of offenses are coming in. It's really, we don't actually have the information to say this is what's driving the population up, or what's driving the length of stay up. We do have a number of policy options that can be introduced in Alaska to get that length of stay down, regardless of what the cause was, though.
Okay. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, we're being asked to look at this from 2005, so 10 years back, and I'm not trying to be critical, but I guess in my own way I am, because we have to try to determine why people are staying an extra 3 days on an average longer, and to go back and look at what we did in 2005 and how many people were let out on bail, how many people, so on. So it doesn't seem like it's that difficult. So what I guess I'm really asking is, why can't you go back that 10 years and find that information? Because, you know, we can do some guesses. And just like you had indicated, you know, maybe judges, magistrates are having a higher bail. Maybe people don't have the money, so obviously they're staying longer. But we also could, we should be able to go back and look at the data 10 years ago. So is there, did we not collect the data? Really, what is that reason?
So that data is not collected in any aggregate way anywhere in the state right now. So there's no central... there's no database anywhere that shows over any period of time, even today, what bail was set in terms of financial money bond. What bail was set, was the person able to post that bond and be released? And if so, how long did it take? That's something, we wanted to collect some original data, so we sent staff around to 5 different courthouses mm-hmm. around the state to collect about 300 sample cases. At random and try to collect some original data, but to actually collect a full year's worth of data or 10 years worth of data is a project that's just too big for our staff to take on, and it's not currently in a computer anywhere. You have to actually go through individual court files.
So, yes. Mr. Chair, so I'm not super familiar with CourtView, but enough to know that there are, people's names are out there. It certainly shows on the dockets how much bail, so on and so forth. One would assume that that's already, it's already put in the system, it's already filed, that you were unable to utilize that from your data collection?
So CourtView, we did look at the possibility of using CourtView, and I forget what it was. There was something about it that was information that we couldn't determine based on what was on CourtView that made it impossible for us to collect that data. But I don't actually remember right now what that thing was. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
For the record, the Representative Munoz has been with us for a while by teleconference. And if you have a question, Kathy, just sing out, we'll get you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question on this subject.
We'll get you the answer, Lance. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. So one of the things I want to clarify is really the scope of the work that you were doing. Now, my understanding, I think, was that we had tasked you mostly with looking at corrections. And it looks like specifically on the pretrial portion that corrections, that just a focus on the corrections department would not be able to give you the full scope of what the challenge is and what we might be able to do to address that. Is that correct?
So the corrections population, or the people who are in prison at any given time, are there as a result of a lot of different decision makers. And so in terms of policy areas that could be changed, we'd be looking at policies that are set by law enforcement, by the courts, by the legislature, by the Department of Corrections, by the parole board, by probation. So there's a whole bunch of decision makers whose decisions actually result in what we see in the prison population at any given time. So the charge was take a look at what's driving the prison growth, provide data analysis to the Criminal Justice Commission on what's driving that growth, provide some technical assistance around what's the best research in the field about what works to change criminal offending behavior and to get better outcomes pretrial. And try to walk through, here's what some other states have done that have been facing similar issues, and then help the commission come up with recommendations. And so the recommendations will be broader than just applying to corrections, but they will all be sort of based on who is in the correction system.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah, can I follow up on that? Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. It helps me understand that, at least specifically on this piece where we're looking and seeing a huge challenge, that it's more than just corrections that is a part of this particular discussion. But that being said, immediately in my mind, I tend to go, okay, well, then there's the court system. It's pretrial. But there's obviously, you've highlighted a few other things, public safety and some of those other things. In the end, when you come back to us, will there be things that the legislature will need to do through statute changes related to maybe it's policy we put in place, but does that also include the court system, public safety, all of those things? Really what I'm getting to, are we going to be able to address this, or will it get lost in the muck and mire of regulations where in the end someone comes back to us with a recommendation on policy, but instead because of all the different natures of the different groups and wanting to own your little piece, we end up stuck in the same place that we're going to be?
So the commission was charged with developing recommendations for statutory and budgetary changes. So they will for sure come up with recommendations for statutory and budgetary changes. I think, in the process, the commission has done a lot of outreach to different stakeholder groups, including, for example, they've done several crime victim roundtables around the state. And there are recommendations that come from those stakeholder groups that are really about just administrative level changes, saying if you would change this, that would really help this stakeholder group out. So I imagine some of the recommendations will also be those regulations or will be those policy and practice changes. The charge that the commission was given, though, was for statutory and budgetary changes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Go for questions, Representative Munoz, followed by Edgman.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Dan, then put me in the queue, please, Dan.
Okay, and Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question has to do with the period going back to 2005 and whether or not you've been able to identify particular statutory changes that have occurred in that time frame and their impact on the prison population.
The answer is yes. We haven't gotten to this section yet when we talk about what's driving the growth in the sentenced population, but what you'll see when we get there is that like the pretrial population, the growth in the sentence population is not because more people are coming in and being sentenced. It's because people are spending a lot longer in prison, or not even a lot longer, a little bit longer in prison times a lot of people. So the legislative changes that have affected or that have very likely affected the sentenced population and the growth in that population happened in 2005, 2006, the changes to the presumptive sentencing scheme for felony offenders and for felony sex offenders. So you'll see, when we get to that section, you'll see really significant growth in length of stay for felony offenders.
Thank you.
Any follow-up? Representative Munoz?
Thank you.
Hearing no follow-up question, go to Representative Edgman with the question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of pretrial numbers, it really seems to me that Alaska has an inordinate amount on a percentage basis of pretrial prisoners. But my question would be, how does Alaska compare to other states in terms of the amount of pretrial prisoners that we have?
So this is a tough question to answer, again, because Alaska's prison system houses people that in another state would be separated, so that another state would be a county jail, which would have a pretrial population and people who get sentences of less than a year, and have that separate from state prison of people who get sentences of longer than a year or something like that. In Alaska, because it's all together, it's hard to actually say what portion of the total population should be pretrial. This doesn't seem terribly out of the ordinary to us in terms of the proportion of people. The thing that is worthy of attention is the growth in that population over time.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, my follow-up question would be then, will you have any recommendations on maybe how to better measure it from the Alaska perspective? Because I go back to some of your earlier comments about how you really don't have the information. It's really hard to analyze.
Yes, so there will be some recommendations likely coming from the Commission about data that should be tracked from here, from this point forward, in order to do a few things. We want to make sure that whatever policy package is put in place by the legislature is actually implemented. So you want to collect data on to make sure that it was implemented and then what you thought was going to happen actually does, to set some performance benchmarks for the things that you'd like to achieve, and then track that data to see, are you actually getting that? Those outcomes. Are you getting the reduced recidivism? Are you getting these shorter periods of pretrial stay? Are you getting more people able to afford bail who are not a risk to the public? Are you getting whatever the different data points you might want to gather? So there is likely going to be a recommendation about data collection and also a recommendation about oversight for some period of time to make sure that implementation of the changes happens and happens in the way that it was designed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Thompson, Co-Chair Thompson, got a question.
Yes, thank you. A couple of questions or statements even, kind of. You kind of touched on this to some degree, but if I have read it all correctly and understand some of the things that have happened, it seems like since 2005 we passed quite a bit of legislation that made mandatory minimum sentencing, which is that driving the length of stay in the pretrial? And also, we've made it harder and harder for people to get out on bail. Is there more people now that are waiting trial? Basically, what I'm trying to say is people are going to trial more now, so they have to wait in pretrial in prison, waiting to go to trial. Is there a lot more of that happening now than it used to be because of minimum sentencing or making it difficult for bail?
So I have not measured this. We've heard anecdotally that yes, that since the presumptive sentences have increased so significantly, particularly for sex offenders, that a lot more people who would otherwise be plea bargaining and have a much shorter pretrial period are going to fight it, and they're actually going to go to and have their trial. And so if they are detained, they end up being detained for a much longer period of time than they used to be. There are other things that that may be at play that are not driven by that those sentencing changes, but that for sure could be part of the picture.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gura, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thompson asked some questions that I think are important. I've got two flip questions. One, even though I want to reduce the nonviolent criminal defender population in jail where it's justified, I'm not yet convinced about the statistic, so help me here. More people in pretrial custody, and that is expensive unless the substantial majority of those folks are going to, if that counts as time served, which it does, for people who end up getting convicted, would it really be a savings to reduce that number substantially when they're there, if most of them are going to get convicted? I don't know the answer of that. When they're there serving part of their sentence, because in the end that would just be a wash.
Right.
They were there for pretrial, but then the rest of their sentence is going to be shorter. So what's the answer to that?
So in a state where people are getting credit for the time that they served detained pretrial toward their sentence, you're right that if you were to make changes only to pretrial length of stay, that you may not have a very big change in overall length of stay in prison, assuming that group of people is going to be sentenced to some period of time in prison. The charge that the Criminal Justice Commission has been given is to make changes to both, to make pretrial length of stay changes, to make sentencing length of stay changes, so that overall you are getting a complete impact and not just shifting the impact from one part of the system to the other part of the system. There are some things that are hard to measure. We know there are studies about for people who spend the entire time during their pretrial period detained, they are more likely to get a sentence of imprisonment than people who did not, people who were released at some point. People who spend the entire time detained are also likelier to get a longer sentence than they would otherwise have gotten compared to similar defendants who served for shorter amounts, who were released at some point during the pretrial period. There are people who are detained for, say, 30 days pretrial, and then they get a sentence of time served when maybe the judge would have given them time served for a shorter amount of time. Or they get a sentence of time served when maybe the judge would have gotten them given them a longer amount of time, but they've already served 30 days. There are a lot of things that are a little bit hard to measure in this arena. And so when we come up with a team of data analysts that are coming up with a projection model. So when there are different policy options that are put on the table, they'll put those policy options into the model and see how that affects the prison population 10 years down the road. There are some assumptions that they have to make about time served and about how this part of the system affects that part of the system. That stuff is a little bit over my head, but for sure this is there's a lot at play here, and it's a little bit difficult to measure some of these things.
Sure. I look forward to seeing that. Here's something that you said you didn't know why, in some cases, we're having a higher number of people in pretrial. And, you know, there's always been this discussion in the fishing game area, which is biologists will look at statistics but not speak to local people to try and get local knowledge actually matters. Well, here, you may not have statistics, but I think anecdotally, if you speak to people who practice in the area, they'll tell you more and more people are getting very onerous bail conditions like 24-hour third-party custody for very minor crimes. So you might not have the statistics, but isn't it worth it to speak to those practitioners to see if that's happening, at least in their experience? I know it happened in the very short time that I practiced criminal law. Judges just felt safe to make sure nothing happened. You just gave everybody third-party custody, 24-hour third-party custody, and they couldn't find third-party custodians, and so they sat in jail. So have you spoken to practitioners, even though there aren't statistics?
We have both the Criminal Justice Commission itself and the staff for the commission have done a lot of outreach. All of their meetings are public meetings. They've held public hearings around the state. They've traveled as a group out to remote and rural communities to hold public hearings and listen to stakeholder groups. They have asked for input and feedback from prosecutors, from defense attorneys, from local law enforcement, from state law enforcement, from crime victims, from researchers and academics, from people who are involved in the system and their families, from practitioners on probation. We've spent hundreds hundreds of hours on the phone and in person interviewing people who are practitioners in different parts of the system, judges, and court administrators and Department of Corrections administrators. So lots and lots of input has been given into here's what we think is going well in the system, here's what we think is not going well in the system, and that can't all be quantified, for sure. We did try to quantify the third-party custodian thing. We gathered a random sample. We did 300 case files to look at bail conditions, and we found of that random sample, about a quarter of them were people who had been ordered to have a third-party custodian in order to be released. So a third-party custodian is somebody who is going to provide, it's a citizen, someone who's going to provide supervision of a pretrial defendant in the community if they're going to be released. The conditions can be very extreme, so it can be 24-hour supervision. You're going to have this person sleep in your room. They're going to go to work with you. Or it could be something less than that. And what we found was that, so a quarter of the cases, that's a lot of cases, to have a condition that's that restrictive. What we found was that only about 25% of the people who had that condition were able to actually meet it and be released. The people weren't able to find a third-party custodian to actually provide that supervision for them. In every single one of those cases, if someone had a third-party custodian condition, it was always on top of money bond. And so they would have to raise a certain amount of money and then also find a third-party custodian in order to be released. One of the areas that the commission is interested in examining is third-party custodian conditions. And generally, what sorts of pretrial services should be available to help judges feel comfortable releasing people? What kind of services would you need to exist in order for a judge to say, okay, you can be released pretrial? So that's something that they are working on, and they're going to have recommendations very soon about that.
Thanks. Mr. Schuster, thank you for the diversion for questions. We're on slide 7. I'll ask you to proceed.
So let's move on and talk about the sentenced population.
Slide 8.
This is just sort of the chapter heading slide highlighting. This is the population that we're talking about, the sentenced population. This population has also grown over the last decade. I've switched slides to now the line graph showing growth over a 10-year period. So the sentence population has grown 14%, so it's not growing quite as fast as the pretrial population, but this is we're talking about a bigger number of people, and so a 14% growth is still a significant growth over a 10-year period.
Can I ask one quick question?
Representative Guerra.
Are your numbers adjusted for population? So, I'm sympathetic to reducing the number of people in jail where it's appropriate and safe for the public, but hasn't the population gone up by a similar number? So doesn't necessarily stand out unless you've adjusted it for population growth.
Right. So over this 10-year period, the resident population's gone up about 10%. If we were seeing the resident population growth driving the prison population growth, what you would see is more people being arrested, more people coming in, because there are just more people. We want to look at, and we'll look on the next slide, how many people are coming into the system being arrested and being sentenced to prison, and then how long are people staying on their sentences. I'm going to go ahead and go to the next slide to sort of make this point here. Looking at admissions in the sentence population.
Just for those online, despite declines, 82% of prison admissions are misdemeanors, is the slide. They want to know online when we're switching.
So this looks like the slide we saw before about the pretrial population, except we're looking at admissions to prison for sentenced offenders. We look at the entire year of 2005, who was admitted to prison on a sentence, and 2014, who was admitted to prison on a sentence. And what we see over this period of time is that there are fewer people being sentenced to prison. So if the population growth was driving the growth in the prison population, we'd actually see more admissions, and that's not what we're seeing here. The growth here seems to be driven entirely by length of stay in prison as opposed to number of people coming in.
Mr. Schuster, I think the genesis of Representative Garrett's question is, do you adjust these by population growth, you know, the regular civilian population? I don't see that the numbers are reported as a percentage of population. They're just raw numbers.
Right. These are raw numbers. I don't have this graph here, but we did do a prison utilization analysis that did account for the rate of prisoners per 100,000 residents, and that showed growth as well. So even controlling for the rate, there was significant growth. When you look at the overall growth in the prison population, it's 27%, and the resident population growth is about 10%. So the prison population has been growing about three times faster than the resident population. And that has been driven largely by length of stay, as opposed to more people coming into the system.
Great. Any questions? Representative Pruitt, question?
So, real quick, we have here is snapshots, 2005 and 2014. If we were to look at 2013, 2012, and a couple of those others, more near-term years, would we also see a decrease in those particular years as well? Is this a trend, is really what I'm asking?
It is a trend. I don't know the answer right now, whether every single year would be kind of staggered in that downward direction or if there is some variation. Yes, this is a trend. So over that period of time, the population has gone, or the number of admissions has gone down.
Any other questions online? Hearing none, go ahead.
So the other main takeaway before we move on to the next slide, again, we did color blocking based on the severity of the convictions. So the green segments of this bar represent misdemeanor offenses, and the purple segments of the bar represent felony offenses. So one noteworthy thing is that 82%, this is in the title, 82% of prison admissions last year were for misdemeanor offenses. So the vast majority of people who are coming into prison as sentenced offenders are coming in on misdemeanors as opposed to felony charges.
And help me out, what would be a violent misdemeanor?
So a misdemeanor assault. If there is a bar fight, that's a misdemeanor assault. If there is domestic violence, that's often a misdemeanor assault. That could sometimes be a felony.
Next
so I'm moving on to the next slide, and this slide looks at nonviolent felony offenses, and it looks at their average length of stay over time. There are light blue bars on this graph that represent the average length of stay in 2005, and dark blue bars that represent the average length of stay in 2014. And what you can see is that across the board, again, there's an increase in average length of stay for people who have been sentenced to a term in prison. If we look at the bars on the far left, the property bars, and then the ones to the right of that, the drug offenses, on average, they're staying about a month longer in prison than they used to, so not a huge increase, about a month longer. For alcohol and public order offenses, they're staying about 3 months longer than they used to 10 years ago. So, again, a 3 month increase doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it's these small increases multiplied across thousands of people that adds up to a lot of prison beds that the state wasn't using before. So there is this real policy question for the legislature, for the Criminal Justice Commission, about what are you getting for that extra month in terms of public safety? What are you getting for that extra 3 months? Could you take the money that it costs to incarcerate someone for those extra 3 months and spend it in a different way and actually get better outcomes in terms of public safety and reduced victimization?
I'm going to betray my lack of experience with the prison system and just ask the question. Someone who's arrested and is awaiting trial, are they in a separate facility from someone who has been sentenced after trial? Are there other pretrial facilities versus prisons?
I don't know how to answer this very accurately here for Alaska. There certainly are pretrial wings, and there are some facilities that are designated as pretrial. I believe almost every facility in the state has some combination of both, but I believe that there may be someone in the room who can answer.
Tell you what, Josh, why don't you come up? Yeah, got to come up on record. Just give me your name and affiliation. Just appreciate that free flow.
Joshua Wilson, Alaska Correctional Officers Association. And, yes, there are state facilities, say, like Seward, Spring Creek Correctional Center, which are just sentence facilities, but a majority of facilities, Anchorage, Mat-Su, Goose Creek, they have pretrial as well. So, and we're a unified prison system, so both pretrial and sentence are in the same system.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for using your lifeline. Very good. Representative Garrett, question.
Yeah. Tell me if it's in a later slide, and then I'll just wait. And tell me if you've looked at this. But, you know, unfortunately, this is now a fact. It's not just a theory. But if we've got a heroin epidemic in this state, and now a spice epidemic, but let's just focus on heroin for a second. You go over to the Heroin Addiction Treatment Center because you want to get treatment for your heroin addiction. You should be lauded for that. And what you're told is you can't get in unless you're a federal priority pregnant person, or there are a couple other categories, you can't get in. And if you're on heroin, what that means is that you leave and you go get more heroin and you enrich your drug dealer and you commit a crime and your drug dealer commits a crime. Have you done any analysis on the difference in cost of jailing people who are seeking addiction treatment but can't get it, as opposed to putting them in jail? Is that beyond the scope of what you're doing? Because I think that's an insane policy.
So I can't speak to that policy specifically. Here's what we know. In Alaska, it costs roughly $142 a day to put someone in prison. Any type of treatment in the community is going to be less expensive than that. I don't know if residential treatment, if somebody was actually going to be committed to a hospital or something like that, I don't know if that would be less expensive or more expensive. So I just don't know the answer to the question. For the most part, justice reinvestment efforts across the country have been focused on, and then sort of the phrase justice reinvestment is about focusing the prison beds that you have on the most serious and violent offenders, and then achieving some savings by not using prison as an answer for everything, and taking some portion of those savings and reinvesting them into things that are needs for the community, like substance abuse treatment. And so the justice reinvestment concept is about getting better outcomes out of your system by spending money differently, including on treatment for substance abuse.
And the chief, did you say those recommendations will be part of your report?
Yes.
Our recommendations? Okay.
And again, to clarify, it's not Pew's report. It's the Criminal Justice Commission's report. We provided data analysis for them, technical assistance, but it, we don't ever come in and make recommendations.
Thanks.
So the slide we just looked at is nonviolent felony offenders, looking at their lengths of stay. They have gone up. The next slide looks at violent felony offenders, and their average lengths of stay have also gone up. So here you can see from the title, felony length of stay is up 17% for offenses against a person and 86% for sex offenses. This graph here looks only at people who have already been released. So there are some people who are in prison for very long periods of time and they haven't been released yet. And if they haven't been released, we didn't include them in the average length of stay because they only have an admission date, not a release date. So they didn't make it into this data set. So this is actually a conservative estimate of length of stay because it doesn't include those people with very, very long sentences. There was a question earlier today about changes by the legislature in sentencing. This is, I think, the area where it's most relevant. So where we see felony person offenses, felony sex offenses, the sentences for those offenses in Alaska over just the last 10 years have gone up. In most cases, they've doubled, or the available presumptive sentence has doubled. And so these sentence lengths have gone up quite a bit. And you're going to see, I think, into the future, these numbers are going to continue to increase because of those statutory changes.
Yeah.
And maybe you're going to get to this, and if you are, please tell me to just wait. But as we talk about specifically, and I see the sex offense, and I know there's a lot of collateral consequences with the specifically sex offense. You know, you get out, you can't live near certain places and all those things that we appropriately have put in place, but we have to think about in terms of how it affects our prison population. Are those also items that you guys are taking a look at and helping us understand ways that we might be able to manage those issues as well? Is that part of the, is that involved in this? And I know that's probably more into the next category, not necessarily the sentenced individuals, but those that have, those that have violated in some capacity their parole or their release. But is that part of the, what you're looking at?
So the Criminal Justice Commission, yes, is looking at collateral consequences of criminal convictions, including collateral consequences for specialty types of offenders, so conditions that only apply to sex offenders or conditions that only apply to a certain type of offender. So the Criminal Justice Commission has a longer lifespan than just the period of time that that Pew is providing technical assistance. So we're providing technical assistance around justice reinvestment, which is specifically about containing corrections growth and getting better outcomes in terms of public safety. There are additional things that the Criminal Justice Commission is going to continue doing after Pew has gone away. And so the collateral consequences stuff is on that list of things that the commission is doing outside of this justice reinvestment work.
So, thank you. I appreciate that. So, but have you, in your thought process, are those collateral consequences not part of the cost drivers? I mean, if we've got individuals that are, you know, they're spending more time because we determine that's the policy that we want them to spend more time. And then on top of that, we have added into it the different items that may create some of those challenges. Is that not part of it, or is it just because they're already dealing with it, you guys have said, go ahead and continue to deal with that, we'll focus on, we won't focus on that at this particular time?
I think in terms of actually creating a projection model where you can project the prison population 10 years down the road and how different policy changes would affect that population, there are some things that are, that you're on pretty solid ground in terms of making assumptions when you put it into that projection model. So something like taking something that is a maximum one-year sentence and changing it to a maximum six-month sentence, that sort of thing, that's something you can very easily calculate.
Right.
Or taking, you know, average pretrial length of stay and reducing it by a certain amount, or change, making some kind of policy change that's really specific and measurable. That's stuff that we generally feel comfortable projecting. There are a lot of other things that for sure could have an impact that we don't feel comfortable projecting. So things like changing collateral consequences and changing driver's license stuff and having programming in place that's targeting, that's aimed at reducing recidivism. Those programs are great, and those types of changes are really can be really effective and helpful for people who are in the system. But we're not on really solid ground running that through a projection model.
I understand. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I just want to know if you've broken any of this down. Sex offenses range from things that are, you know, unspeakable, rape. Probably not going to convince a lot of people to reduce a sentence on a rape, even though all of the sex offenses were almost doubled in terms of sentencing a number of years ago. But there are lower-level crimes that are called sex offenses that should be crimes. But let me give you an example of one, and I want to know whether you've looked at it by category of crime. The lowest level of sex offense that was raised in the bill the legislature passed a number of years ago was somebody who touches somebody through their clothing, passes through a bar, does something obnoxious, should be a crime. That's now a four-year minimum. Four-year minimum, maybe a six-year average sentence. Have you looked at, and frankly, I think that's insane in most cases. That should be based on what the facts are in the case. So have you looked at each category of the sex offenses and even some of the lower ones to see whether what they're doing to the prison populations?
So, yes, the Criminal Justice Commission is looking at these different categories of sex offenses and trying to identify, is there any low-hanging fruit in that group for some policy discussion? For the most part, most of people who are in prison right now on a sex offense are in on a very serious sex offense. There's not a ton of people in prison on what you might think of as a lower-level sex offense.
That said, there's a policy discussion right now. I think they're trying to come up with some consensus or see if there is any consensus around some changes affecting either prison admissions or length of stay for sex offenders. I'm not sure where the commission's going to land on that. It's a really diverse group of people on the commission, and I don't know if there's going to be consensus around sex offender policy changes.
Interesting. If your goal was to whet our appetite for more analysis and more reports, you certainly have succeeded. Can't wait to see this. I've got a question. The growth of the prison population, can you have it broken down by age, perchance? I'm not sure if this one here, if it's more old people, more young people.
Yes, so the fastest growing segment of the prison population is those who are 51 and older. It's not the biggest portion of the prison population, but it is the fastest growing. And so one policy option that the state may want to look at is, there is this phenomenon about aging out of criminal behavior, particularly violent criminal behavior, that for the most part, people who are engaging in violent criminal behavior are in their teens and 20s and 30s. By the time you reach 45, 55, 65, you become much less of a threat to the public. When we look at a prison population that is aging, the cost-benefit starts flipping when the population starts getting older. So when you have growth in your oldest segment of the prisoner population, that becomes the most expensive prisoners to house in terms of medical care, and it becomes the least cost-benefit in terms of public safety of locking this group of people in prison.
So benefit defined as reducing violent offenses or dangerous crimes.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. I guess the question is, why, any analysis as to why the fastest growing proportion is those older than 51?
Right. So I think if you look, if you're looking at prison populations, you can look at how many people are sort of churning through for short stays, or you can look at people who are coming in and they're not going anywhere, they're going to stay for a really long time. Both of these different types of scenarios add to prison growth. You have lots of people churning in and out of the system and coming back. They are more likely to be younger offenders. For people who are going to come in and stay in because they've committed a serious crime, because they're not going anywhere, the more of them that come in, the older the prison population gets because they're not going anywhere. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So one of the policy options that states have taken on is coming up with some kind of geriatric parole option. It is a little bit funny to say it, right, but there are for sure across the country there are entire prisons or housing units that are geriatric units where everybody who is housed there is over a certain age, and it's an expensive group to house. These policy options generally are not automatic. They wouldn't be an automatic release for anybody. It would be sort of a trigger for the parole board to take a look at them after a certain amount of time. So it would be something like for prisoners who are 65 years old who have already served at least 20 years on their sentence, they would have a trigger for a parole hearing, and the parole board would be able to take a look at their stay in prison and their original crime and other relevant information and make a decision about whether they need to continue being locked up and give the crime victim an opportunity to participate in that decision as well.
Right. You wouldn't want Charlie Manson to get out because he's old, but you might want to trigger and ask the questions.
Right.
Okay, interesting. Okay. We'll make sure other folks online, legislators online, have a chance to ask any questions.
Yeah, this is David Guttenberg. I have a question.
Representative Guttenberg, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. A little earlier you mentioned, being able to predict behavior, in some contexts all of us are looking for a silver bullet, and I know there isn't one, but you were talking about behavior and predictability. And my concern was, we're just looking at prison sentences and time spent and all those things. But getting back to a larger, and I don't know if the Pew Foundation is doing this, but change behavior in society that leads to prison time, Are you guys tracking anything of the changes that are going on in Colorado and Washington and then soon to be Alaska, where the changes of the marijuana laws and how it's going to relate to what other crimes are being committed or not being committed?
You know, I don't know how, I don't know if we've had enough time in states that have legalized or decriminalized marijuana to know how that has affected crime rates in those jurisdictions. I just don't know the answer to that, or if we've had enough time to really track that. I know for the most part in Alaska, or I think this is actually an absolute, there's hardly anyone in Alaska prisons for marijuana possession. It's not a crime that lands a lot of people in prison, or at least not for very long if they do land in prison. In terms of, you know, you mentioned trying to predict criminal behavior. All criminal justice decision makers, all, you know, judges and law enforcement and the parole board and others are in some way trying to manage risk. They are anticipating that someone who is released to the community could be a threat to the community and could go out and hurt someone again, and that's a risk that nobody likes to take. It is the business of criminal justice, and almost everybody who comes into prison is going to be released at some point. So the question in terms of a policy question are, what are the tools that these decision makers need in order to make those decisions well, in order to manage risk in an effective way? There are risk assessment tools that can be really helpful. So at the pretrial stage, the risks that you're worried about are the risk that someone's not going to show up for their court hearings if you let them go, or the risk that you're going to release them and they're going to go back and they're going to hurt the victim again. For the sentenced population, the risk is once they get out of prison, they're going to go out and they're going to commit another crime. So recidivism is the likelihood of new criminal activity. It's a different kind of risk. It's got different statistical predictors. And essentially what any jurisdiction would do is design a tool or adopt a tool that can be used to help you predict someone's likelihood of failure, likelihood of reoffending, likelihood of missing their court dates and that sort of thing. These things are predictable, so people who get scored as high risk do fail at higher rates than people who get scored as low risk. But it's not a crystal ball, it's just a tool to sort of help guide someone's professional judgment. And so for sure there will be policy recommendations that center around how to use the best tools available to help do this risk management.
Is that good for you, Representative Guttenberg?
It's getting there. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'll go ahead and move on. We're now looking specifically at supervision violators. These are people on probation and parole who violate the terms of their probation, so they show up with a dirty drug test, or they lose a job, or they miss appointments, or those types of violations that are technical violations. If someone who's out on probation or parole commits a new crime, they're not going to show up in this population. They're going to show up, again, in that pretrial population because they're going to come in on a new crime. So here again is a snapshot in 2005, a snapshot in 2014.
And this is, for those online, number of supervision violators up 15% is the slide run now.
Sorry about that. I switched the slide. So this just shows that the number of supervision violators who are in prison on any given day has gone up. And then the next slide tries to break that down into a more detailed image. So I'm moving on to the next slide. This one's a little bit complicated, so I'll take a second to explain it. On the screen, you're looking at the number of admissions to prison for a probation or parole revocation. The 2005 bars are the light blue bars, and the 2014 bars are the dark blue bars. And then across the horizontal axis here, we're looking at how long of a revocation. So was it a short revocation? Someone's going to come back in and stay for less than a week, or someone's going to come back in and stay for a month, stay for 3 months, 6 months, a year, et cetera. So what you can see as we sort of broke this out was that almost across the board, except for the very longest periods of time, there were more people who were revoked to prison for probation and parole violations in 2014 than there were in 2005.
I'll ask the question that's on everyone's mind as well. How does that compare with the rest of the country? And understanding the county jail dichotomy, but
so across the country, this is has been one of the biggest focuses of criminal justice reform. When you look at who is in prison on any given day, people who are in prison because of a technical violation of a probation condition is pretty much your lowest hanging fruit. These are people who haven't necessarily committed new crimes. They're out on probation or on parole, and they've been coming in on a technical violation. Some of those technical violations for sure are serious. So some of those are things like there's a protective order put in place to protect the crime victim, and they violate that protective order. If that's not considered a new crime, that would be a technical violation of their conditions. There are lots of people who, however, come in because they had a dirty drug test or they were caught drinking or something like that, which for sure is serious and is behavior that probation and parole officers want to respond to in a way that is meaningful. But prison is one of the more expensive ways to respond to that type of behavior.
So the question that comes to my mind is the parole system, parole officers, is that system inadequate to the task, or are the conditions so strict that it's impossible to meet them? Help me understand.
So I think the way that different states have approached this issue is not to ask the question of, like, is the parole agency unable to handle this task? I don't think that's the way people have been approaching it. I think instead what they've said are, what are the options that they have available to them to sanction behavior that is troubling behavior? And can they do it? Do they have authority to do it in a way that's swift and certain, and it's going to actually have a deterrent effect on that behavior? If the system is designed in a way where, in order to punish someone for messing up on probation, it takes 3 months to get them into court and in front of a judge, and because it's not a swift and certain response, it doesn't actually act as a good deterrent for the problem behavior, and so it doesn't actually change the behavior. The big shift in the country has been around creating systems that are designed to have sanctions that are proportional to the problem behavior that can be imposed right away, and where the sanctions are really clear to offenders who are on probation up front. So they know, if I mess up, if I miss this appointment, this is going to be the sanction, and then it actually gets imposed whenever they do mess up. So one version of this that you're probably familiar with is the PACE program here in Alaska. The PACE program is for high-risk probationers and parolees who have a substance abuse problem. And so they're going to be tested regularly for substance use, and they are going to know exactly what the consequences are if they get caught for using. So the consequence is going to be something like a short jail stay of 1 to 3 days. 1 to 3 days is not a very serious penalty. It's long enough to be annoying. But it's not long enough to really disrupt somebody's life. It's not so long that they're going to lose their job and their house and custody of their kids. And so having a response that is annoying enough that I want to avoid that consequence, but not so disruptive to my life that it ruins all the good things that are going on in my life that actually make me likely to succeed, that's the sweet spot.
Interesting. Question, Representative.
Thank you. Maybe you know this, maybe you don't. So let's just use the issue of somebody who is on probation. They start drinking again, and they come back in, and now they're spending 50% more or twice as much time in jail. Is that related at all to the inability to get them into a substance abuse treatment program? So is there a relation there at all? Because obviously somebody who's got an alcoholism problem, and frankly I think it's naive to assume somebody with a major alcoholism problem isn't going to drink even if you tell them that it's on probation if they go through shakes at nighttime by not drinking, but is there any correlation between the lack of availability of quick entry into an alcoholism or treatment program to this statistic?
I think there likely is. I can't measure that, but there is interesting research that talks about something slightly different, though, which I think is really fascinating. So you have, in Alaska, you have this program called 24/7, which is not about getting people into alcohol treatment. It's just about testing them, saying, we're going to test you twice a day, and if you've been drinking, we're going to know, and you're going to get a short, you know, jail penalty. If you've been, you know, if we catch you drinking, then you're going to get punished. And for a large portion of people who have substance abuse, just being held accountable with that sort of monitoring is enough to get them to stop drinking. For some people who go through that sort of system and it's still not enough, those are people who should be really high priority for getting them into treatment. So for sure there is some portion of the population that has substance abuse needs that can actually desist from substance use simply with the right sanctions in place.
If I could follow up on that question, I think goes to the heart of it. Are there studies you might know of nationally, it's an obvious subject for study, is alcohol or substance abuse treatment a cost-effective response to alcohol-related offenses? Every time I read in the paper that there was an accident, a fight, a DV, alcohol was involved.
Right.
So does treatment solve that? Is it more cost-effective or not? Or
yes and no. When we look at what are the factors that make someone likely to commit crime in the future, substance abuse is one of them. Mm-hmm. It is predictive of future criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. It is not the most predictive of future criminal behavior. So there are other factors like antisocial thinking patterns or antisocial peers that are much, much more predictive. So if, for example, antisocial thinking pattern is something like rationalizing behavior that is not okay, coming up with a way to say, oh, well, to not hold yourself accountable for something that you do that is hurtful to other people or harmful to other people. So having antisocial thinking is a predictor of future criminal behavior. If someone has both antisocial thinking and a substance abuse need, treating just the substance abuse doesn't necessarily prevent them from engaging in future criminal behavior. So, for example, you can imagine, another one of the things that is predictive but not a very strong predictor is employment. So there are a lot of efforts to help get offenders jobs when they get back out into the community. If you get a job, you get stable, and that will help you succeed, right? So you can get someone a job, and that can help them gain some stability. But if they're still stealing from the cash register and excusing it, then you haven't really addressed the criminogenic thinking. You haven't addressed that antisocial thinking pattern. Yes, substance abuse is helpful. The best type of substance abuse is substance abuse treatment that is aimed at addressing criminogenic needs like cognitive behavioral thinking, you know, trying to change the way that you behave and change the way that you think and hold yourself accountable instead of excusing behavior that's antisocial.
Can you explain that a little more deeply? I kind of missed it.
Sure.
Criminogenic.
There are risk factors that make someone likely to commit crime in the future. And those risk factors, some of them can never be changed. So your age at first arrest is very predictive of future criminal behavior. Your current criminal history is predictive of future criminal behavior. Your current age, there are these kind of crime-committing years, right, that make somebody more likely to engage in criminal behavior. Those things can't be changed by programming. There are other things that can be changed by programming. So things like antisocial behavior or antisocial thinking patterns, substance abuse, employment, family relationships, these sorts of things. So those things that can be changed, criminologists treat those as needs that can be addressed with programming. So if you can address those things that make somebody risky with programming, then you can reduce the risk that that person will engage in criminal behavior in the future. And that's the best type of criminal justice intervention, is programming that targets someone's individual criminogenic needs, which are those risk factors. So if somebody has both a substance abuse need and also a need that has to do with antisocial thinking, addressing the substance abuse alone is not as effective as addressing both. If you have a program that addresses both, then you're going to have much more success in terms of reduced recidivism than if you have a program that's just about substance abuse treatment.
Thank you. That helps. Appreciate it. Questions online? Hearing none. Okay. Go ahead, sir.
So the slide we're on right now is about more people coming in on probation and parole violations than there used to be. The next few slides have to do with recidivism and costs. So I'm moving on now to the next slide. The title of this slide, almost two-thirds of offenders who are released return to prison within 3 years. Let me explain this. So the bar on the left represents the portion of offenders who are released from prison in fiscal year 2002 who return to prison within 3 years. So by or before fiscal year 2005, 71% of people who were released from prison came back. The bar on the right represents people who were released from prison in fiscal year 2011. 63% of them returned to prison by or before fiscal year 2014. So good news and bad news. Good news is recidivism has gone down in Alaska pretty significantly, so from 71% down to 63%. There are a lot of different programs that are effective at reducing recidivism. Alaska has made this a priority to get more of these programs in place, and you're seeing outcomes that recidivism has gone down in Alaska.
Question, Representative Pruitt.
Just clarification. Do these numbers reflect people who have committed another crime and are resentenced to another, or does it also include those individuals that have the parole violations that we were just speaking of?
So this includes any return to prison, so it does include parole violations, and it does include people who were arrested but not convicted. The flip side of this, besides that the good news that recidivism is going down, is that 63% is still high. And I'm sure everybody in the room and everybody on the phone would like to see that number come down further. So despite the growth in the prison population, despite the numbers going up in all types of inmates, we're not necessarily seeing great results in terms of return on investment and recidivism.
I guess real briefly, compare those to other states, national trend, national percentage. Where do we stand relative to the rest of the country?
This, again, is hard because Alaska is unique. So a return to prison in Alaska would be different from a return to prison in another state because it includes things that those other states would weed out, right? Because those states would not include a return to jail, for example. So if somebody goes back to jail in Texas or Oklahoma, they would not be counted in the three-year return to prison number. But in Alaska, they would be counted because there is no jail. It's all state prison. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That seems like that would be not too difficult to add the two together down south to get some idea where we're standing nationally. Maybe it's not that important to know how we stand nationally. Just always curious to see if there's something specific and unique about Alaska.
As far as I know, there are national statistics that track state-by-state recidivism rates, mm-hmm. and I don't know of one that is able to sort of parse out or to sort of actually compare in an apples-to-apples way Alaska with these other states.
Okay.
It might be doable. I just haven't seen it. So let's talk about costs. We're moving on to the next slide.
What does it say?
Is there a question online? Go ahead, sir.
The title of this slide is Spending on Corrections is Up 60% Over the Past Two Decades. That's adjusting for inflation. So what you see here are the actual numbers that are not inflation adjusted from 1995 through 2014 of the operating budget for the Department of Corrections. When you adjust that for inflation, the increase is 60% over this period of time. This only includes the operating budget, so anytime there was a capital expense of building another prison or expanding a prison just repairing a prison, that's not included in these numbers. That would be additional.
And just to clear your numbers a bit, so if you adjust for inflation, there's been a 60% increase.
60% increase over this 20-year period.
And that's a raw number. That's not per capita. That's not per inmate. That's just statewide total.
Right. That's just a dollar increase.
Good. Representative Gaddis.
And just a quick question. You said it was $142 per inmate. Did that include the operating costs only, or did that also, since we're talking about capital, did that include the proration of capital?
I don't know the answer to that question. This is $142 a day is a number that was given to us by the Department of Corrections, and I don't know what goes into it. I assume it is operating costs and not capital costs, but I don't actually know the answer.
That's my assumption as well. Thank you.
So last year the state budgeted $327 million for operating costs for the state correction system.
Next slide.
This next slide looks at, it looks back 10 years and it looks forward 10 years. And if you can see, the line actually changes colors in 2015. From that point forward, it's a projection, and from that point backwards, it's average daily population in Alaska's prisons. So what we see on this chart are a number of things. The prison population grew 27% over the last decade. That was the first slide that we saw, actually. Looking forward, the prison population is projected to grow by another 1,400 beds. That is, again, an average daily population. The dotted line that goes across this chart represents the state's hard prison bed capacity to house these prisoners. So by 2017, the number of prisoners will have surpassed the state's capacity to house them, and that will require the reopening of a facility that's been unused for several years. Yes?
We had the state of Alaska recently legalized recreational use of marijuana, and one of the points advocating for that was the tremendous savings we might occur achieved by not imprisoning people for marijuana offenses. I think I heard you say that's not really a factor. I guess that's more an editorial comment than anything, really. I'll ask the question then. What do you account the projected increase of 27% being due to?
So the projected increase is based on the growth rate of the past 10 years. So the projection looking forward is a set of assumptions that from July 1st, 2015 onward, no additional policy changes would be made. It's not an accurate presumption because there will be policy changes made, right? But for the purpose of the projection, we assume no policies are changed. The existing statutes around sentencing, around pretrial release are going to stay the same. The existing practices around probation and parole and how to respond to violations of probation and parole stay in place, and no changes would be made. If all of those things are assumed, the population is projected to continue to grow. By 2017, we're talking about opening up a closed facility. By 2018, that facility would be full, and then we're talking about shipping inmates out of state in order just to keep up with the demand for prison beds. So the cost of reopening the closed facility or the unused facility and shipping offenders into out-of-state beds and contracting for those beds over a decade adds up to at least $169 million over that period of time, over and above the current operating costs for the Department of Corrections. If the state were to decide to keep inmates here in the state instead of shipping them out, then the cost would likely be much higher. So as a point of reference, the cost of the Goose Creek facility that was opened in 2012 was about $240 million for those capital costs and about $50 million annually to operate.
So your question.
Thank you. So now you're talking about the continued rise in prison population and the extra costs. Before, the prison population, the number of crimes seemed to be pretty close to the population growth. Would you attribute, I want to make sure I'm walking away with the correct answer, would you attribute the largest increase in prison costs to be the increase in sentence stay?
Yes. So the increase in the prison population so far has largely been driven by longer lengths of stay, both for the sentence population and for the pretrial population. It's not been caused by more people coming into the system, with the exception of probation and parole violators. But with that group, we are seeing more of them coming in. So looking forward, we're not necessarily talking about crime going up, and because crime is going up, more people are coming in. We're simply talking about growth because people are staying for longer periods of time, and that starts stacking on top of other people who are remaining in the system.
Now, I'm going to ask a question that's kind of the flip side of that. Is there any correlation between the amount of crimes committed in the general population of the state and the number of people who are incarcerated? In other words, can you assume that there's going to be fewer crimes committed in the general population of the state if there are more people incarcerated, or less, or not a factor?
So there have been criminologists are very interested in this question of does more incarceration lead to less crime? And they've studied this in a couple of different ways. So the biggest crime decline that the state, that the country saw was in the mid-90s. And so criminologists have examined the 90s, and they said this is a time when prisons were rapidly expanding across the country. Was the crime decline caused by that prison expansion? Or how much of it was caused by that prison expansion? The answer that they came to was yes, prison expansion had a role in the crime decline in the 90s. The estimates vary about what portion. There's general consensus around somewhere between 10% and 30% of the crime decline was related to more imprisonment. And it's really hard. This is starting to get a little bit complex. So it's hard to actually say it was this percent of the crime decline that was caused by the increase in incarceration, because there were a lot of other things going on during that time. So one of the biggest things was that baby boomers aged out of crime generally. So baby boomers got into their 40s and crime went down. There was a waning in the crack epidemic. So there was just much less demand for crack cocaine, which in the 70s and 80s had been really closely associated with violent crime. There were changes in policing practices. There were changes in personal security practices. So people started locking their doors more. People started carrying around less cash. There was changes in technology, so there were more video cameras in stores and things like in alarm systems. And so it's because there are all these changes happening at the same time, it's really hard to isolate the impact of prison on crime during that time. There is general consensus among criminologists that since the 90s, the value of putting one more person in prison is significantly less than it was back then. There was this period of really fast prison growth across the country where the line graph just looked like it was skyrocketing. And at that time, it was a pretty good bang for your buck to put somebody in prison. But generally when we look at putting one more person in prison today, the people who are now going into prison are smaller fish. So, you know, the millionth person you put in prison is a smaller fish than the first 100 people that you put in prison. And a lot of this growth is being driven by longer lengths of stay. So we see, like we were talking about before, as prisoners get older, the cost of housing them in prison goes way up, and the value in terms of reduced crime goes way down. And so the cost-benefit shifts, and the value of continuing to incarcerate more and more people now is a different cost-benefit than it used to be.
Right.
So diminishing returns.
I'll make one observation and ask for from here. So we should be cautious of sweeping generalized statements about this causes that, or this is obviously more beneficial matter. It's insane to do this, or it's genius to do that. There's a lot of nuances. There's a lot of teasing out of the causes and effects here is what you're saying. Is that correct?
With regard to crime, yes. With regard to recidivism, no. It's actually we have really, really good research on what works to reduce recidivism.
Okay.
So for people who are, and that's sort of the difference here, is crime is a macro outcome. You look at crime rates in the state, for example. Recidivism is an individual outcome. So what makes an individual less likely to commit crimes in the future? What types of interventions with that person work and are effective? And there's a really robust body of research on that. It's much more well-defined than what reduces crime.
Great. Thank you. Representative, question?
Yeah, thank you. So as we look at this chart and we look at the potential growth, one of the things I haven't heard you talk about is the effects of electronic monitoring, both in other states or potentially here. Because, of course, for us, it's a newer thing we're implementing. Of course, certain parts have been around longer. We've had recent legislation on it. Can you talk to me a little bit about that impact and it's specifically as we're looking at the cost factor, its impact in either the number of people that would potentially be in prison. And in turn, that cost to us. Have you seen it in other states? What can you shed some light on in terms of our state?
So Alaska has in place a couple of different types of electronic monitoring. There is electronic monitoring that is monitored by the Department of Corrections, and it looks similar to someone would be on house arrest, and they would have a schedule every week for when they're allowed to leave the house, and they would be tracked by someone, by a probation officer out in the field. There is also private electronic monitoring, so a company that you would pay them to supervise you on electronic monitoring on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, and it's not supervised by the state, but it's something like if you get a third-party custodian condition, then you can hire an electronic monitoring company to be your third-party custodian in certain parts of the state. There's not a lot of research on whether electronic monitoring works, for whom it works, when does it not work, or when is your, what's your best bet for who, how to use it and how to get the best outcomes. That research is being done right now, so there are randomized control trials being done. We're going to see what comes from that research. In terms of costs, it is much less expensive than a hard prison bed. It is likely more intensive than regular probation. And so it seems, just from a cost perspective, it's a middle ground between probation and prison, and it has some extra guarantees with regard to we know where this person is and whether this person has been drinking. But the research is still out.
Obviously, we're not the first ones to invent this. I mean, other states have done this. Is it still that new in other states that we just don't have definitive evidence that whether it's a whether it's a discussion about a monitoring during parole or using it as a tool for pretrial or a tool for maybe an early release mechanism in other states that have been doing this for longer periods of time? We just don't have that data. Part of the question, we don't have that data to be able to look at other states that have been doing it for a while to say to show the benefit potentially in one of those different sectors of utilization.
So there are people out there who have been using it and who say this works. When we look at, I think, you know, this is sort of about, like, what level of evidence is enough evidence, right? So you have anecdotal evidence which has value to it, but it's not necessarily scientific. You have, you know, somebody who's put a program into place and has been tracking the outcomes, and they say this program works. And then you have more scientific studies, which are things like randomized control trials, where you're going to have a control group, you're going to have an experimental group, and you're going to try and match samples in each to make sure that they're similar groups and then find out, you know, what are the results. It's that level of evidence that doesn't exist yet. There for sure is, you know, there are parts of the country or there are programs in place that have measured their own outcomes and say this is working really well. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it works. We just don't have these high-level analyses that are kind of more scientific.
Separate from the scientific analysis, which is a little bit more detailed, takes more time, and I think I understand it. Those other two categories that you've mentioned, where other states have tracked and they felt that they may be bringing a benefit, have you found in some of those states where they've said it doesn't work at all? Or is there a tendency in the limited amount that we have, again, not knowing that there's not that scientific evidence,
yes,
that generally states find that there is a benefit, whether it's a financial benefit, maybe a benefit in terms of actually dealing with your prison population? Is there are they seeing a negative impact? You're putting violent offenders back into homes or something.
Yeah.
Is there a general consensus for the most part out there on the benefits or negatives that exist?
I just don't know the answer. I think there are likely arguments for this is going to save the state money because we're not using a prison bed. There's also arguments against that are about net widening, that essentially you'd be using electronic monitoring for people who weren't going to prison anyway, and so you start kind of increasing the number of people who are getting that intervention, not as an alternative to prison, but just because it's available. I don't know. Generally, the best analyses that are out there are these meta-analyses that are studies of everything that's out there, and they try to eliminate the things that are not really scientifically sound, and they give the most weight to the types of analyses that were the most statistical and scientific. And then they say, we've reviewed everything in the field on this subject, and here's what we found. That doesn't exist yet.
I meant the last one be the last one, but this one I think is for sure. Do you have an idea of when we can expect that type of analysis to be available for us to utilize?
3 to 5 years.
Just because it's brand new, is it they've been working on it for 10 years, and we think in 3 to 5 years we'll finally be at that point, or is it just something that people are just now starting to think of, let's go ahead and look into this, and we expect in 3 to 5 years to have that analysis?
So for sure, there's a lot of interest. There, I think for the first time, is interest among the people who fund scientific research or criminology research. And so the funding has now been set aside for this research to be done. I think it's going to take 3 to 5 years for it to be done.
Other questions here or online?
I have a question. This is Rep. Wilson.
Go ahead, Rep. Wilson.
Okay, so kind of have electronic monitoring and with HB 15. And on the slide where it said it was 28% pre-trial, and now that prisoners would be given credit, whether they're sitting in jail or not, we're going to have to wait 3 to 5 years to find out whether something like that works? That seems like an awful long time.
So in Alaska, if there was a policy change put in place here, the legislature could require data to be collected and outcomes to be monitored. So you could actually track for the people who are going into this new type of program or this new type of policy, what are their recidivism rates? Are they staying out of prison? Are they, you know, or sort of even smaller, are they able to maintain a job? Are they able to continue paying restitution? Whatever outcomes you're most interested in, the legislature can actually require that those outcomes in Alaska be tracked, so that you should be able to, 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, see your own local outcomes for the local policy change.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Wilson.
So on the 50% that we have sentenced, and the Department of Corrections has been doing electronic monitoring, maybe not to the extent, especially when we're looking at some of our villages in which it costs a tremendous amount to house our prisoners. Should they have that data? Have you found that they already have that data on electronic monitoring in their own program? Have you asked for that?
I don't know the answer to this. Department of Corrections likely does have some of their own data on those who participated in electronic monitoring and the outcomes that they have seen with that population. I don't have that information today.
Okay, and one last follow-up, and maybe I missed this. So in your final report, will it tell us how we can get our numbers down? Will those be some of the specifics on what kind of legislation would more likely bring down the numbers versus other types of changes?
Yes, so the Criminal Justice Commission's report will come out on December 10th. It will come out with options for the legislature. So the Senate President, the Speaker of the House, and the chairs of this committee and the Senate Finance Committee asked for options. Said, please come back to us with a policy package that would avoid all this future growth that you see on the slide right now. One option that would not just avoid this growth, but would bring the population down by 15% over 10 years, and then one option that would bring the population down even further, 25%. So depending on the extent to which the commission actually reaches consensus, they should be able to come back with options and say, these are policy recommendations that are for legislative and statutory and budgetary changes. Here is the impact of those once we run it through the projection model. So 10 years down the road, if you pass this full policy package, your prison population will be X. And then it will also have a dollar figure connected to it. So the commission will work with the Department of Corrections to try to estimate if the population were to come down whatever the amount is. So if it's 8%, if the population were to come down 8%, what would be the marginal cost savings, or what would be the annual savings possible with a smaller population?
And Mr. Chair, this is a request. Could we ask the Department of Corrections for their numbers on an electronic monitoring program so that we would be able to have that when this other information is released, or when we have the next meeting, perhaps after December 10th?
Representative Wilson, we'll make that request to DOC. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
This is really just editorial because I received one phone call this summer. I mean, I know we want data. Data makes sense. You can make better decisions with data. But in a world where you're cutting employees in these agencies, they're going to hire a prison guard before they're going to hire somebody who collects data. And so I think people just have to be cognizant of that. I know at McLaughlin I've received a sort of anonymous complaint about the inability to collect data anymore because their priority is to keep people safe and keep people from engaging in violence. So, editorial comment.
Go to the search. Go ahead, sir.
So this is actually an old slide about next steps because a lot of these dates have passed. So the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission was charged with making sure that cost of doing nothing slide doesn't happen, and saying this likely growth in the prison population, come back to the legislature and the governor's office with recommendations for how to avoid that growth or how to get better outcomes and curb that growth. So they've met throughout the fall in September and October. They're meeting again this week to continue having their policy discussions. They've examined what other states have done in a lot of detail. They spent hours and hours working through different options for the legislature, and we've been working with a team of data analysts to try to project what would be the impact of those policy changes so that they have an idea if they're even in the right ballpark in terms of impact. These recommendations are not finalized yet. They will be finalized very soon. And so the recommendations, you should be able to have them in hand on December 10th.
I was going to ask you, is that going to be a draft report, or is that going to be the final?
That'll be the final report.
Okay. Good deal. As you can tell by the questions, there's a lot of interest, and I anticipate it'll get good readership in the committee. Other questions? Go ahead.
Throughout the legislative session, if you all have questions about those recommendations, about the data behind them, about the research behind them, the technical assistance staff from Pew will be available to respond to those questions. The commission members themselves have a lot of expertise in this area. They've spent hours and hours and hours talking through all of it, and so they'll make themselves available as well. The new chair of the commission, Greg Razzo, has offered himself as often as he is needed by the legislature to be here to answer questions.
Mr. Schuster, if folks want to get with the Pew team, the research team, that they can get through you, your contact number is two slides down.
Yeah.
Would they go through you? Or?
Sure. Yeah, so you can go through me. You can go through the staff for the Criminal Justice Commission, which is the Alaska Judicial Council. So Suzanne DiPietro is here today. Mary Geddes is the staff attorney for the Criminal Justice Commission. Either of them can be a connector to the right person with the right information.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'll see if anybody have questions. Representative Guerra, and then we'll go online.
You can go online first.
Sure. Anybody in the far-flung teleconference world have a question for Mr. Schuster?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munoz, go ahead.
Thank you. Recently I was contacted by a family who has a family member who has been in and out of prison for years. This individual has diagnosed mental health issues. And the family has had a very difficult time in trying to get kind of involuntary commitments or treatment for the individual to keep them out of prison. I'm wondering if the commission has had an opportunity to review, recidivism and mental health, diagnosed mental health conditions and recommendations for addressing those issues in our system.
Thanks for that question. Yeah, so part of the information gathering that the Criminal Justice Commission has done is spending a lot of time with representatives from Health and Social Services, One of the members of the commission is the head of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And so one of the regular, topics of conversation is for this population of people who end up in prison in part because of a mental health issue, what kind of intervention, be it prison or something else, would be the most effective and would be the most fair and would be sort of best for the state. So for sure there will be some recommendations. I think it's likely there will be some recommendation that mental health treatment and other types of treatment be a priority for reinvestment, that if there is significant savings achieved through focusing prison beds on serious violent offenders, that some portion of that savings could be going toward mental health treatment services and other services in the community for that segment of the population that lands in jail and prison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a follow-up to that, we in my office have looked at what other states are doing and have found a law referred to as Joel's Law. I believe it's the state of Washington, where a family can petition the court for involuntary commitment for mental treatment, mental health treatment. And I'm wondering if the commission has delved into this issue or looked at what other states are doing.
To my knowledge, the commission has not. But the commission does have a life beyond this legislative session. They sunset after 3 years, and so they've been holding public hearings and public meetings and are considering the issues that are brought to them. So this issue has been brought to them and may continue to be brought to them to consider after this legislative session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we will follow up with the commission on some of our research. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions online? Kawasaki, Guttenberg, Edgman, anybody?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Edgman.
Go ahead, Representative Edgman.
Thank you. I want to commend the presenter for a really good presentation. This is a subject that the chairman of the Budget Committee for the Department of Corrections I'm somewhat familiar with, but every time I attend one of these presentations, the more I learn. I guess to distill things into a quick question, Alaska tribes, I don't know if I heard anything at all mentioned. I did have to step away a little bit today. But has any of your work, any of your emphasis, any findings, recommendations, whatever it might be, have anything to do with Alaska tribes?
The recommendations are not finalized yet, so I don't know if there will be a recommendation that's specific to the tribes or the remote communities. There has been a lot of outreach. So I know that the chair of the commission and technical assistant staff from Pew presented at the Alaska Federation of Natives. The commission and their staff traveled out to Nome and Kotzebue and surrounding villages in order to meet with people in rural and remote parts of the state to get their input and do sort of a listening tour. We also, one of the crime victim roundtables was specifically a roundtable focused on rural and remote populations around Bethel. There were a number of Native voices and elders who were speaking on behalf of crime victims at those roundtables. There for sure has been a lot of gathering of input from different stakeholder groups, including from Alaska Natives. I don't yet know what the recommendations of the commission are going to be, if they're going to be very specific to Alaska Natives or if they're going to be any different for smaller communities, remote communities versus more urban communities. We'll see.
Follow-up, Representative Richmond?
Yeah, I think just to maybe make my question a little bit more targeted, and again, I did miss part of this presentation, so it's probably something that maybe I'm just not failing to comprehend, but if I go to the first slide, it talks about Alaska prison growth drivers and costs of the Pew Charitable Trust, but my question would be, in any of the analysis that the trust has done, do you have any work that is attributed to the role of Alaska tribes in the criminal justice system in Alaska.
Well, I'll tell you what I know, and then tell me if I'm not kind of hitting the points that are most interesting to you. There is a disproportionate number of Alaska Natives confined in Alaska prison system. According to the census, Alaska Natives represent about 15% of the resident population in the state. They represent about 36% of the prison population. If we look just at the probation and parole violator population, they represent about 42% of that group on any given day. And so there are disparities that are ethnic disparities in the system. The policy fixes for those disparities may or may not be targeted at Native communities. So there could be a policy change that applies to anyone who is responding to a probation violation, that applies to all probation violations. And that policy change would disproportionately impact Alaska Natives because they're disproportionately included in that population. It could be that there are really broad policy changes that would have a really big impact reducing that disparity, and it could be that there are really targeted policy changes that are specifically different types of interventions or diversion options for Native communities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get that on the record. Clearly, I think we all know that, speaking of the disproportionate nature of Alaska Native population in our prison system, I think the number is, in terms of those incarcerated, is what, 37-38% last time I looked at it. A large component of that is younger Alaska Native males who more often not come from smaller, isolated, non-road system-connected communities in Alaska. So appreciate the response, and just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Hedgman. Good question. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I think you may have alluded to this before, or else I just imagined it. So one specific question, one general question. Trying to deal with people who've committed crimes is one thing, but it's not a solution until you also try and reduce the number of people who ever commit a crime in the first place. And so the question is, are there things that we can do to reduce the number of people who commit crimes? I know there have been studies, and you can tell me whether these are accurate, that say low-income people who have access to quality pre-K end up committing crimes in smaller numbers. So the question is, A, is that correct? You're a better researcher than I am, the thing on pre-K. And then B, are you going to be addressing any of the things that would reduce the number of people who end up getting involved in the criminal system? It's sort of a fool's game to have a larger society of people who've committed crimes and just say that's okay without trying to reduce it.
So in terms of prevention, we're more likely to look at things that will have an impact in the next 10 years as opposed to things that would have an impact 15, 20, 30 years out. I actually don't know the research about pre-K. I'm just not familiar with it. I'm sure it exists. So, in terms of in Alaska, what types of crime prevention efforts are effective? There are a lot of things that are currently in place. You know, there are dollars that are set aside for prevention that are thought of as crime victim dollars that are about either there's a lot of innovation, sort of grants for kind of small programs throughout the state around either prevention of domestic violence or sexual assaults or other types of prevention, so prevention of violent crime, prevention of kids drinking. That innovation, I think should continue. There may be a recommendation coming from the commission that's about continuing to fund or expand funding for local intervention or local prevention programs, but I just don't know a whole lot more than that. Sorry.
Just one last question, Mr. Chair. Only if you know. So with the decrease in funding sort of statewide on many things, do you know, does community policing reduce crime? That's like having a number of officers dedicated to a particular high-crime neighborhood. Do you know if that reduces crime?
I don't know that research offhand.
That's fine.
I mean, generally, there have been big changes in policing practices over the last 30 years that for sure have impacted crime. I can't say what the research says about what portion of crime reduction was attributable to that. So across the country, crime has gone down steadily since the 90s. And so from the mid-90s to today, throughout the country, crime has just gone down and down and down. And there are a lot of questions about what has caused that. Or whenever we hit the point when crime starts going up again, what will have caused that? There's just not a lot that is known or that's measurable, because there's just so many things that could be impacting at any given time, whether it's, you know, a new drug that is on the rise, or whether it is changes in personal practices or changes in technology or changes in whatever. I think it's really hard to say. I'm sure there is somebody out there who has tried to zero in on that type of policing practice, but I just don't know the research.
Thank you. And just to clarify, the focus of your work is not so much on crime prevention, although that's a laudable goal, and it's actually on recidivism per se, right?
Right. So it's a sort of a our specialty area is looking at the data about growth in the prison population, mm-hmm. identifying what's driving the growth, and then examining what sort of policy options could stop that growth or curb that growth.
So if your focus of recommendations is on that specific topic, that shouldn't call them into question. You know, you're trying to do a specific job for a specific tool.
Right.
Representative Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've got a couple questions. And so I'm circling back around to the programs that my friend on the right of me may have spoken about. So in your report in December, will you be discussing some of the Alaskan programs that seem to be working, some of them that maybe have promise, and maybe some of them that don't seem to be working? Will that come out in the report? You talked about programs and grants and some of those things out there.
Right. So I need to distinguish because Pew is actually doing more than one project in the state. So one of these projects is called Justice Reinvestment, and one of the projects is called Results First. And they're both focused on criminal justice stuff, and so they are a little bit confusing. The Results First project is helping the state come up with a budget tool that actually identifies the cost-benefit of all the different programs that exist in the state. That's not something that I'm working on with the Criminal Justice Commission right now, though. That's a separate project that is being worked on.
Okay, but that project will address that question, correct?
Yes.
Okay, I see people in the audience nodding yes. And so my second question is in regards to things like youth court. And so is it your thought that program will also be addressed?
So I don't know. Again, so the commission has not come to consensus yet on what the recommendations are going to be. There are, for sure, a lot of different specialty court programs around the country and here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And those specialty court programs have been shown to be really effective. They don't always have a huge capacity. They can't always handle lots and lots and lots of people. And so the cost benefit may be high cost, even if it is a high benefit as well.
But we'll get that data, be it one your report or I'm saying no, we won't get that data. So, to the best of our knowledge, will we get that data?
I'm
not real clear about that.
So I'm going to try to explain a project which is not the project I work on. So with that disclaimer,
is there somebody in the audience that works on that project?
Suzanne, do you want to come up?
Just to be real clear, because they do certainly have a dovetail with one another.
And make sure it gives your name and affiliation.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and I am working with the University of Alaska's Justice Justice Information, I've got the name wrong, I'm sorry, but the newly created Justice Information Center at the University of Alaska, and we are working, I'm on the steering committee for that organization, and we are working with the Results First, the Pugh MacArthur Results First team on the Results First project. And the first phase of that project, which we're working very hard on right now, is to put together a list of all programs in the state that are designed to reduce recidivism and to get some information about how much those programs cost, who's in those programs, that kind of thing. So that will be, I think, maybe the first, or at least the first in a long time, of an actual list of all the programs. We hope that to be quite comprehensive. That will, I think, get a little bit of your question answered. Mm-hmm. And then if you stick with us, in about a year or so, or 9 months, we will have more information about the cost benefit, the cost and benefits of those programs that will go to the legislature and that you can use as a decision-making tool as you look at your expenditures and the results that you'd like to get. Did that sort of answer your question?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So what I'm hearing you say is that you won't have your information to us, especially the cost and benefit one, for another 9 months, but the Pugh Charitable, I'm sure we've got a lot of different names here, let's see what we're calling ourselves today, Alaska Prison Growth Drivers and Costs will be up in December of this year. So approximately a year later, give or take a few months, we'll actually have the information on the costs and benefits of some of our programs. So we're going to be asked to make a decision without all of the information is where I'm going.
So I think there are two different types of initiatives. One of them is to give you all a tool that you can use for the rest of forever to make budgeting decisions, to actually take a look at for each program that exists, what's the cost benefit mm-hmm. for every dollar that we get that we put in, what are we getting back in terms of reduced recidivism and less crime. So that's a tool that you should be able to use for budgeting decisions for a very long time. Separate from the development of that tool, there is this process right now that's looking at what's driving the growth in the prison population, looking at sentences, looking at bail and pretrial decisions, looking at how are officers responding to probation violations and parole violations and that sort of thing. And the recommendations for addressing those things are separate and apart from the sort of tool that you'll be able to use on an ongoing basis. It would be a one-time set of recommendations for changes in statute.
And thank you for the clarification. Thanks.
And Suzanne, so give me a name, describe again briefly the program, who's in charge of it, the one you just described?
So the program, the Results First program, which is a project of the Pugh Charitable Trust and the MacArthur Foundation, is housed right now at the University of Alaska Justice Center at the Justice Advisory Information Center. It's a new acronym. It's a newly created organization. I'm sorry that I'm butchering the name, and I know that Andre Rose at the Justice Center and Dr. Brad Merstall are probably listening on the line right now, screeching that I can't remember the name exactly. But there's a steering committee, a multi-agency steering committee that's working on that project. This center is an ongoing concern, and the first year of the center's existence, we've decided will be spent standing up this tool, so finding all the data and the information that needs to be fed into this tool so that we can make reports out to the legislature, and the center will have other projects after that, but it will continue to sort of, for lack of a better word, be the home of this decision-making tool and provide information. The main reason for its existence is to provide information to you and other policymakers about programs in the state.
Okay.
Did that answer your
it helps.
Sort of?
It helps. Okay. Yeah. a lot of different programs, a lot of different efforts, and a bunch of names, a lot of justice.
This is David Guttenberg. Can you put me in the queue?
Actually, Representative Guttenberg, you're up.
Okay. So my question is, I guess not surprisingly, it tags on to Representative Guerra's comment about, going backwards. How do we keep him out of the system? Just to talk about, we've been told that the average reading level in prison is third grade. I don't know how accurate that is. Okay, so go back. We won't go into pre-K or early learning programs before they get into prison. But once they're in prison, is there, I imagine that there are GED programs and reading programs. Is there any comprehensive work done on that aspect of recidivism, increasing the education level, and what that does?
So there is for sure research about increasing education level and increasing job prospects and helping with job placement that are focused on just generally increasing motivation among offenders to stay away from crime. When we look at the predictors of future crime, education level is not a very strong predictor of future crime, and IQ is not a very strong predictor of future crime. It is for sure a valuable thing for people to be doing while they're incarcerated, and for sure something that I know a lot of inmates really value, having the opportunity to continue their education or get vocational training while they're incarcerated and increase their job prospects. But as far as I know, what has been studied on what is actually predictive of future crime, educational achievement is not statistically predictive.
Along those lines, I'll ask this question. Is there any research that would indicate whether recidivism rates are higher or lower in a low unemployment economy? In other words, if there are more jobs, does that help reduce recidivism?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Okay. But lots of fascinating research areas to explore.
Yeah.
Other questions? Anybody here or online? I think we're running out. Okay. For the record, Mr. Pretros was trying to reference the Alaska Justice Information Center. That wasn't very good, so Brad's happy. Good deal. Seeing, hearing no further questions, Mr. Schuster, I thank you for your time. Obviously, there's a lot of interest. It's a fascinating presentation. I think the slides are going to be up on BASIS on the committee meeting schedule, so those who want to see these presentations online can access them through the BASIS system, and we'll look forward to the report and the recommendations to the Judicial Council. Seeing nothing else come before us, it is now 11:20 a.m. Emerger, and thank you.